A working-class teenager looks his middle-class teacher in the eye and asks, "What are you doing in a dump like this?" The question cuts deeper than simple rudeness. It reveals a painful truth. The student has already absorbed what his crumbling school building, outdated textbooks, and overcrowded classrooms are teaching him, that he doesn't matter. This moment, captured in a profound exploration of moral education, reveals something most of us would rather not acknowledge. Schools don't just teach algebra and history. They teach values through every peeling paint chip, every dismissive interaction, every sorting mechanism that separates the gifted from the regular. Young people are constantly watching us, not listening to our speeches about character, but observing how we actually behave when we think no one's paying attention. They notice when we preach equality while maintaining separate tracks for rich and poor students. They see when we demand honesty while cutting corners ourselves. The real moral curriculum isn't written in any handbook. It's enacted daily through the structures we build, the shortcuts we take, and the uncomfortable truths we choose to ignore.
When Dave challenges his teacher about American democracy, citing poverty and racism as proof ideals don't match reality, Ms. Santos engages thoughtfully. She asks which countries he'd prefer and guides the class toward considering why living somewhere you can change matters. By postponing her planned lesson, she demonstrates that difficult questions deserve thoughtful responses, that intellectual responses matters more than comfortable narratives. This is modeling in action. Successful science competition teams thrive through real challenges students own, supportive mentors who respect them, and communities valuing curiosity. These environments mirror urban sanctuaries, spaces where young people are treated as resources rather than problems, where adults challenge and support through genuine relationships. The conditions fostering ethical development mirror those promoting intellectual growth, being known, respected, challenged, and supported. Yet many high schools make this nearly impossible. When teachers face 150 students daily, meaningful relationships dissolve into anonymity. Students watch how we organize our institutions and draw accurate conclusions about what we truly value.
Carl sits in class, bored and frustrated, because nothing connects to his life. Teachers dictate opinions without asking his. Math insists on single right answers. His passion for music gets dismissed. When he offers computer help, something he actually knows, he's rebuffed and labeled irresponsible. All day, he's treated as an empty vessel. This intellectual vacuum creates a moral one. Powerless people lose the instinct to help when repeatedly rejected. Yet struggling with that computer manual would have fulfilled education's true purpose, applying what he knows to learn more. True growth happens when talent intertwines with content, when students contribute something adults actually value, not through empty self-esteem exercises, but through genuine achievement. We consistently underestimate young people's capacity for serious thought. Teenage mothers, young soldiers at D-Day, all prove adolescents aren't delicate flowers. Most already confront serious dilemmas involving substance abuse, poverty, and violence while adults look away. They resist mandates but willingly examine moral choices when trusted to develop their own conclusions. Literature, like To Kill a Mockingbird, provokes ethical exploration. Science raises questions about defining life. Mathematics prompts philosophical inquiry about zero. The deeper students dig into any discipline, the more they want to learn, especially when questions become their own. Yet deep grappling remains rare because teachers lack support for subject mastery, curricula prioritize coverage over depth, and schools fear political fallout. They resist mandates, but willingly examine moral choices when trusted to develop their own conclusions. Literature, like To Kill a Mockingbird, provokes ethical exploration. Science raises questions about defining life. Mathematics prompts philosophical inquiry about zero. The deeper students dig into any discipline, the more they want to learn, especially when questions become their own. Yet deep grappling remains rare because teachers lack support for subject mastery, curricula prioritize coverage over depth, and schools fear political fallout.
Angela stares at 30 unread Hemingway pages, planning to fake it, sit in back, look unwell, pick up enough from discussion to comment intelligently. Her teacher, Elaine, hasn't prepared either. Juggling two young children and stacks of papers, she'll wing it by drawing from student comments. Both engage in bluffing, that shadowy game of incomplete representation that maintains social functioning without outright lying. Some bluffing eases relationships, but self-serving bluffs raise ethical concerns when pervading education. Angela struggles because interpretive reading requires intellectual effort after exhausting days. Elaine cuts corners because teaching doesn't fit school hours. With over 100 students and no planning time, she must sacrifice home life or resort to bluffing. Schools that tolerate bluffing teach academic corruption. Overload is the primary cause. Quantity becomes quality's enemy. Most American high schools rely on standardization, seven-period days with disparate subjects and numerous extracurriculars, creating busyness where depth is sacrificed for appearance. Schools must ensure teachers know students well enough to detect bluffing and provide appropriate pacing with reflection time. When we create conditions making bluffing necessary for survival, we teach that appearances matter more than substance, a lesson students absorb completely. Tom faces difficult high school choices: magnet school, neighborhood school, private academy, or vocational training. He excels in math and science, but finds humanities boring. He resents being categorized by test scores and fears separation from friends. His dilemma reveals how sorting affects identities, relationships, and futures. Walk into any large high school cafeteria and you'll see intricate social sorting. Ninth grade white girls cluster together, black students form their own groups, beautiful people occupy prime spots, science nerds gather elsewhere. Though teachers describe the school as friendly, rigid groupings reveal underlying fear. Students want to switch groups, but don't dare cross invisible boundaries. The principal touts democratic rhetoric about serving all students under one roof, yet the school maintains rigid academic tracking. Politically powerful parents of academically talented students, mostly white kids from wealthy neighborhoods, demand separated honors tracks. When questioned, the principal defensively responds that students still mix in the hallways. Yet the faculty dining room demonstrates the same segregation patterns. Some sorting is natural: chess players lunching together, track enthusiasts forming bonds. Sorting becomes problematic when it creates winners and losers, especially in academic tracking, where rankings affect future prospects. Many comprehensive schools offer various academic paths resembling shopping mall stores, some upscale, some not, reflecting social class and ethnic lines. When standardized tests show honor students outperforming others, it appears to confirm the system's legitimacy, masking deeper inequities. Schools require structure, but students vary widely in energy, intellectual acuity, interests, and maturity, and they change constantly. Rigid academic tracking persists despite overwhelming evidence it harms learning. Truly fair schools must be massively tracked, placing each student in their most appropriate setting at any moment. When external forces demand harmful sorting practices, school communities must protect their humane policies and refuse to participate in discrimination that brings permanent, unnecessary harm. Samantha, newly tall, enjoys her physical presence but resents being accused of shoving when she's just being playful. The line between horseplay and malice depends on intentions and cultural backgrounds, shaping acceptable physical proximity. Secondary schools are crowded environments where adolescent bodies collide during passing periods. Enforced classroom stillness creates explosive energy release during transitions. Samantha's school reduced physical incidents by having students develop their own horseplay policy. However, subtler forms emerged: inappropriate jokes, slurs, and invasive personal discussions that enter psychological space without permission. Rudeness threatens school communities attempting to function as small democracies, yet thoughtful curricula can explore when breaking boundaries serves higher purposes. History's intellectual heroes, from Galileo to civil rights leaders, pushed boundaries benefiting society despite resistance. Teachers must help students understand that certain forms of trespassing require evidence and courtesy rather than raw power. Cheating represents shoving at its worst, entering spaces one hasn't earned. Rather than simply condemning boundary violations, schools should help students examine their purposes, contexts, and moral dimensions. Students notice everything. They see us preach equality while maintaining separate tracks for rich and poor. They watch policymakers demand rigorous testing while expecting flexibility for their own children, moving kids to private schools while defending public education, and demanding small classes for their offspring while accepting overcrowded classrooms for others. A school's goodness depends on what each person brings daily, principle in every decision. Rules like no violence require thoughtful application in particular situations. Principled behavior springs from reflection and weighing alternatives. Consider dropouts. We'd quit too if trapped in mindless schools. Yet successful programs for vulnerable adolescents feature different routines that enable learning. The personalized attention wealthy families demand would work everywhere. Why should children without advocates suffer while others don't? Students see this hypocrisy clearly. Moral education begins with adults, the lives we lead, routines we establish, and our willingness to devise better policies. The most powerful moral education happens through lived experience, how we treat each other, the values we embody, and the courage we show facing difficult truths.